This is disc number 6.
How's your ankle holding up, Lawrence? Abigail asked.
Doesn't matter. I'm on pure adrenaline now.
Water dripped from the ceiling onto the hood of Abigail's jacket. The air smelled dank of water and minerals.
What is this place?
She asked.
They used to call it a shoe fly,
Lawrence said, his voice echoing off the rock and trailing away deep into the mountain.
It's just an entryway into the mine.
She shined her headlamp into the distance, where the tunnel seemed to narrow, and 30 feet ahead, Abigail saw their headlamp beams converge upon a small iron door. 1893. 54. Shadow geese had been placed every 20 feet on the wet, rocky floor, like luminarias for a subterranean party. Gloria hurried along the downward sloping tunnel into the mountain, following the echo of voices in the darkness ahead. The day hole narrowed, and she came at last to a small iron door built into the rock. A man she recognized as the Godsend's assayer manned the entrance, and he offered his hand, escorting her through.
You can head on over that way with the others, ma'am, and do watch your step on this uneven rock.
Lanterns and candles and more shadow geese illuminated the rock in firelight, and as she passed into the main chamber, the whole of abandon overwhelmed her in 100-strong chorus of weeping and shouting and voices in varying strains of panic, bawling, terrified children, mothers and fathers trying to comfort them, many failing to hold back their own tears, a handful of men barking orders, attempting to manage the chaos, huddles of roostered miners cursing whatever breed of heathen dare descend into their canyon, and making pronouncements of war and grandiose predictions of the hell they would unleash on any savage who breached the iron door. And Emma Ilg, flitting from person to person, a manic fly, asking if they'd seen her husband. Gloria found a spot along the wall between two distraught families, crumpled down on the cold rock, and buried her face in the sleeves of her woolen jacket.
Heathens are coming, and Zeke is gone.
She kept repeating it to herself, as if verifying that the nightmare was real, crying harder and harder as the pandemonium lifted to a crescendo. Someone touched her shoulder. She looked up, and for a split second, out of sheer will and hope, she thought she saw Ezekiel squatted down in front of her, and her heart ruptured for him. But it was the shunned madam she'd met last night at the dance hall, 1,000 years ago, shivering under her bright red capote, her burgundy curls dusted with snow.
"It's Rosalind," the old whore said. "What's wrong, honey? Where's your husband? He ride up to the pass with the other men?"
Gloria shook her head, but when she tried to tell her about Zeke, the words froze in her throat. Rosalind sat beside her, reached over, and pulled Gloria's head down into her lap. She pushed back the hood of Gloria's cape and ran her fingers through her blonde hair. A voice rose above the din. Children stopped crying. The rowdy miners hushed. Gloria lifted her head from Rosalind's lap, saw all eyes on Bessie McCabe, who was standing amid the crowd, ripping out clumps of hair and screaming Harriet's name, her voice filling the cavern, reverberating down the tunnels, firelit tears glistening on her bruised face. Stephen Cole rushed through the iron door toward Bessie. He embraced her and they sank down together on the floor, the preacher cradling her in his arms like a baby, rocking with her, whispering,
"Calm down, my child, calm down. We'll find her."
Joss spotted Lana Hartman across the cavern, sitting quietly against the wall, her eyes shut tight, lips moving as if in prayer.
"Al, I told you I gotta see a man about a horse."
They stood 20 feet from the iron door, and even in the weak, shadow-ridden light, Joss saw the boy's pale complexion flush.
"Can't you hold it a little while longer?" he whispered.
"Let me go on down that tunnel there, have my piece of privacy."
"You know I can't let you out of my sight."
"You promised you'd loosen these wrist irons," she whined.
"Hell, Joss, hell."
The young deputy reached into his slicker, worked the keys off the big ring attached to one of the belt loops on his dungarees, and waved it in Joss's face.
"Zeke Curtis'll put me in the boneyard if I let you run a blazer on—"
"Al?"
Joss smiled, watching how easily the boy's face disarmed. Knew for a fact he'd take full advantage if he ever got the chance.
You're too close to the belly. Watch me squat if you won't.
Might have to, Joss, he said, then sighed. Turn around.
Al lifted her black serape and unlocked the wrist irons.
Bring a happy jack, she said,
and Al picked one of the shadow geese off the floor and followed his prisoner into the empty passage. 2009. 55. As Lawrence wrapped his knuckles on the iron, Abigail's headlamp shone on the surface of a door so overrun with rust it resembled brown mold. It stood closed and locked by means of a thick crossbar held in place with a padlock the size of a small shield. Quinn reached into his down jacket and pulled out the key.
Full disclosure, Lawrence. How'd you find this place?
On my final day last fall, I climbed up the east side of the canyon to take a picture of the ghost town from above, and happened to stumble upon this mine. You have to understand, at the time I was so absorbed in my search for Otha and Billy's claim hole that I didn't think twice about this shaft. Besides, there are countless mines above Abandon. Figured it wasn't anything special. But if you found that key in Bart's suite, and it fits that lock... Shit, my heart must be going 100 miles an hour.
I know, mine too. Quinn held up the key. Shall I?
Absolutely. Quinn slipped the key into the hole. Is it working?
Don't know yet. The mechanism feels pretty stiff, so I'm going slow. Don't want to break it off.
Quinn carefully turned the key.
I think it's working.
He slid the padlock out of the crossbar and set it down.
Jeez, that's heavy.
Help me with this, Lawrence.
The two men lifted the crossbar out of the deep iron brackets and dropped it on the rock. With the crossbar gone, the door was naked save for a small lever on the right side near the rock, which appeared to function as a doorknob. Lawrence lifted the lever. From inside came the rusted squeak of a bolt moving. The door swung inward and clanged against the rock, a strong, cold draft sweeping in. The mountain sucking air deep into itself, as if trying to breathe.
Unbelievable,
Lawrence whispered as Abigail felt June's grasp tighten around her hand.
Lawrence, when did you first come to Abandon?
Quinn asked.
1979.
You've got me beat.
Do the honors.
Lawrence crossed the threshold, Quinn following close behind. As she entered, Abigail moved her headlamp along the walls, saw a grouping of holes in a sweep of unblasted rock, the product of a day spent double-jacking more than 100 years ago. She heard Lawrence gasp, and she broke away from June and went to her father's side.
What's wrong?
His headlamp was trained on an alcove 15 feet off to the right of the iron door, his dimming light illuminating a collection of tattered burlap sacks, 10 in all. Lawrence unclipped his backpack, took a deep, trembling breath, then limped into the alcove and knelt on the rocky floor. He reached into one of the sacks. His head dropped.
What?
Quinn asked.
They empty?
Lawrence chucked something through the darkness. A brick of solid gold thudded on the rock at Abigail's feet, then another, and another. She reached down, picked one up. The bar looked small in her hand, but it felt disproportionately heavy for its size. The yellow metal gleaming under her lamp, its surface marred with chinks and divots, cold as a block of ice.
You're holding more than $280,000 right there, Quinn said.
Lawrence wept. Abigail went to him in the alcove, asked,
What is it?
He shook his head.
Waited a long time for this.
Quinn had been rifling through the sacks.
I count 61 bricks, he said.
Lawrence closed his eyes as he did the math.
Almost 18 million. God, my whole body is tingling. Look at that.
His right hand shook in the beam of his headlamp. Abigail glanced over her shoulder, saw June wandering off into another part of the mine.
I'm gonna go check on her, she said.
Abigail struggled to her feet. Walked over to June, found her staggering through the dark, shaking her head and muttering to herself.
What's wrong, honey? Abigail asked.
You okay?
When June looked back, her face had gone pallid and chalky, her eyes sunken, the small woman as bloodless as a cadaver. She turned suddenly and vomited on the rock. 1893. 56.
When Stephen Cole raised his left arm, the noise in the chamber began to wane. Soon there was no sound but the occasional squall of a child. He stood in the center of the cavern, taking a moment to regard the horrified faces, these men, women, and children of abandon who sat huddled together along the walls.
"Would you close your eyes with me?" he said.
Hats came off, heads bowed, children were shushed.
"Father,"
Stephen Cole fell to his knees,
"we come before you on this, the night of our Savior's birth, a greedy, wicked, corrupt assembly. It is a dark hour. We have provoked your wrath, and for that I fall on my face and beseech your forgiveness."
The preacher prostrated himself, his cheek against the cold rock floor.
"I lift up the children to you, dear God. Children, I beg you."
His voice unraveled.
"I beg you, deliver them. Let them not be afraid. And if it be possible, allow this cup to pass."
The preacher's tears ran down into the crevices of the rock. He whispered,
"What of grace? Oh, my Father, what of grace? But not as I, but as thou wilt. In your Son's holy name, amen."
Stephen wiped his face and rose to his feet, dusted the silt from his greatcoat, replaced his visored felt hat. He approached the town blacksmith, a small, well-liked man named Mason Stettler.
"Mason," he said, "I leave the town to your care, your captain. I'm going out that door now, and I'm going alone. If you hear a knock in quick intervals of three, know that it's me, but don't open it for any other reason. Better paint for war."
"Mind your hair, Stephen. Got a shooting iron?"
"Yes."
Someone grabbed Stephen's arm. He turned, faced Gloria Curtis, her wet, probing eyes still grasping for a shred of hope. Stephen shook his head and embraced her.
"Zeke is with our Lord now," he whispered. "With your little boy, be dread not."
Her knees failed. As Gloria collapsed, wailing on the floor, her anguish masked another sound that emanated from the nearby passage. Loud, but brief, a sharp cry of pain. Stephen carried a shadowgi, an old Colt single-action army, and a shotgun up the tunnel. When he stepped out onto the ledge, he extinguished the flame and sat down on the rock. It was a good, protected rincon. The sun had gone away and bled the clouds into a deepening blue that cast the mountains in a gray metal twilight. He gazed down on a abandon situated in the gloom of the canyon floor, lifeless and dark, wondering how those six men fared who'd ridden up to the pass. He wasn't afraid, enwrapped instead in the clutches of the most peculiar detachment he'd ever known, as if he existed somewhere above himself, watching everything unfold apart from the fear and the anticipation. Still, a part of him kept listening for gunshots, unsure if the crack of their reports could carry this far from the pass. Soon it was full on night. He grew cold, his head exploding now. Down in the canyon, specks of firelight winked on. He returned to himself. His hands shook. As the procession of lights moved through the empty town, Stephen took two shells from the pocket of his greatcoat and broke the breech of the double-barreled shotgun, whispering as he slid them home,
"Wilt thou shew wonders to the dead? Shall the dead arise and praise thee? Shall thy loving kindness be declared in the grave, or thy faithfulness in destruction? Shall thy wonders be known in the dark?"
The scalp hunters were already to the north end of abandon, and Stephen watched them turn their mounts toward the chapel, following the tracks of the fleeing townspeople. His lips moved again in the dark.
"Oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass."
Joss emerged from the passageway and took a seat on the outskirts of the cavern, her hands hidden under her serape, blackened and sticky with blood. If a saloon regular saw her, they might puzzle at Al's absence. A reasonable explanation would be required. She'd just set about inventing that lie when the roar of a shotgun filled the passage outside the iron door. Everyone made a collective gasp, children crying, Mason Stettler yelling for every able man with a weapon to come forward, almost 24 springing up, crowding the iron door in a ragtag battalion. They waited. Joss counted 5 staccato shots from a revolver, 3 shotgun blasts, then silence. Stephen dropped 2 shells into the shotgun and reloaded the revolver from his cartridge belt. 2 heathens dead in the tunnel behind him, 2 on the brink. He was unscathed, but his heart beat so fast he couldn't think. More lights approached, already to the chapel several 100 feet below. He could hear their horses snorting, the sound of hooves breaking through powder. He took several steps back into the tunnel, his whole body quaking. He closed his eyes, tried to still himself. The riders closed in on the Rimrock. He exhaled when he saw Otha Wallace and Billy McCabe dismount. They waded through the snow and climbed up onto the ledge, stood just outside the entrance to the mine. Otha's claybank eyed the preacher warily, and as had happened on more than one occasion in the last week, Stephen saw the horse's brown teeth lengthen and sharpen in the firelight. Otha hawked his plug of tobacco into the snow. His lantern hung down at the level of his knees, his face and Billy's all gone to shadow and grotesque patterns of light, eyes shining, breath vapors clouding. Otha wiped the tobacco juice from his chin with the back of his glove.
"You know something, Preach?" he said. "I'm feeling a little red-eyed toward you."
"Why's that, Mr. Wallace?"
"Weren't no engines up at the saw blade. We rode around for..."
Movement in the tunnel drew Otha's eye. He raised the lantern, peered around Stephen, the firelight falling upon one of his fellow miners, John Hurwitz, dragging himself off a pile of bodies, whimpering, his blood running out ahead of him down into the mine.
"The fuck's going?"
At close range, the buckshot excavated most of Otha's face. His knees locked, and he pitched backward over the ledge. Billy had caught only a few pellets in the right shoulder, but as he reached for his walker, the preacher blew a ragged, gaping hole in the boy's chest. Billy sat down on the ledge. He cupped his gloves to catch the steaming handfuls that fell out of him, looking up at the preacher, struggling to breathe, eyes asquint with profound aggrievement. Stephen threw down the shotgun and pulled the revolver.
"God save your soul," he said, and shot the boy between the eyes.
2009. 57. Abigail patted June's back.
"Feel better now?"
June shook her head and spit onto the rock. Lawrence jogged over from the alcove, asked,
"What happened?"
"She threw up."
"I didn't even think about the air. It might be bad. Abby, do you feel strange or woozy?"
June stood upright, wiped the sweat from her face, said in a voice that bordered on defiance,
"It's not the air."
She moved away from them into the darkness, her headlamp flickering across the walls, the ceiling. From 20 feet back, Abigail could barely see her in the fading light of her lamp, just her legs and the illuminated rock around her boots. June suddenly sank down onto the floor and convulsed violently, legs bouncing up and down on the rock, arms flailing as if in the throes of electrocution. Abigail ran to her, dropped to her knees, tried to steady June's limbs, whispering,
"Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, June, look at me."
June went still, her eyes open and glassy and staring straight up at the ceiling, mouth agape, chest heaving up and down.
"Talk to me," Abigail pleaded. "Please, say something. I need to know you can hear me."
As Abigail reached out to hold June's hand, the beam of her headlamp struck on something. She froze. The blood in her veins and arteries and the oxygen in her lungs seemed to congeal. She made an involuntary sound, something like a mewl. The hand of an infant had caught her eye. Less than 5 feet from where she knelt, the bones clearly visible, brown and tiny and perfect, clasping the phalanges of a larger hand. She turned her headlamp away, but it passed over another skeleton, this one adorned with strands of long blonde hair that had matted to the skull, and still boasting jewelry, a gold wedding band on the long, brittle phalange of the ring finger, and a necklace dangling from one of the upper vertebra into the ribcage. Lawrence said,
"Quinn, you need to come see this."
June and Abigail got up. They stood in the center of a large cavern teeming with the bones of abandon. At least 100 skeletons, most still intact, their clothes having long since disintegrated in the cold storage of the cave, moist enough to support the growth of a hairy white fungus that overspread portions of the rock like a network of capillaries. The skeletons were of every size and scattered throughout the chamber in a vast array of death poses. The scene reminding Abigail of some morbid sculpture exhibit. Her stomach was churning, and she wanted to shut her eyes to it, but she knew that would make little difference. This mine and its occupants would stay with her for the rest of her life, in waking moments, in dreams. They drifted wordlessly through the crypt. Most of the skeletons were sprawled across the floor, as if they had lain down en masse to die. Abigail saw one curled up in the fetal position in a corner. Another lay beside a small boulder, its skull cracked, pieces of it on the rock floor pigmented in proximity with the deepest burgundy shade of ancient blood. A pair of skeletons lay along the wall, their humerus and radius bones intertwined, having perished in each other's arms. Abigail felt herself coming undone as the images of the dying townsfolk accumulated. A skull resting in the lap of another skeleton. On a pair of femurs, the leather binding of a pageless King James Bible. Between kneecaps, a clear corked bottle still holding an inch of century-old whiskey. Skeletons sitting up, grasping shotguns and rifles and revolvers, the wood stocks badly rotted or gone altogether. Others clasping bricks of gold with their browned finger bones. A handful clinging to the remains of their children. And under a rusted-out shadow-gi, a skeleton with long black hair tweaked both her horror and her curiosity at once. On the wide plates of its browned pelvis lay minute femurs and tibias and ribs, a skull the size of an apple, phalanges no thicker than matches, and when she realized these constituted the bones of a mother and its fetus, Abigail broke down. Lawrence walked over and sat with her.
"I know," he whispered. "It's a lot to take in."
"Guys," June said, "would you mind turning your headlamps off? I've got Emmett's camera with me and..." She was crying again. "He'd want me to shoot this for him." They switched off their headlamps, Abigail hating the darkness. Not even the faintest presence of light to adapt to in this pure, unfiltered black. She gave June 1 minute, listening to the click of the camera echo through the chamber and the distant drip of water. She finally said,
"Sorry, but I'm turning my headlamp back on. I'm too freaked out to just sit here in the dark."
She found breathing easier with her headlamp on.
"You must be beside yourself, huh, Lawrence?"
"This is beyond anything I ever dreamed of finding. The gold and the entire town in the same place at the same time?"
"It's going to be amazing material. This'll turn out great articles for both of us."
"I don't know about you, but I plan to write a book."
Lawrence stood up, offered Abigail his hand, but she didn't take it, just sat there, staring at a coal oil lantern capsized between two femurs.
"Abby, you all right?"
"I don't know how to process it all. Everything we've been through tonight."
Lawrence hollered through the chamber.
"Quinn, come in here. Have you seen this? We found abandon. They're all in here."
Lawrence tapped his headlamp.
"Damn, my light's dying. Walk back with me to the entrance, Abby."
They crossed the uneven rock, working their way among the skeletons.
"There he is," Lawrence said, pointing the bulb of the light 30 feet ahead. "Hey, Professor, you really need to come in here, see all the bones."
When Abigail's headlamp struck Quinn, he was zipping his backpack. He glanced up at them, said, "I hope it's enough, Lawrence."
"What, the gold? Of course, 18 million is plenty for every..."
"I'm not talking about the gold." Quinn shouldered the sagging backpack. "I mean knowing what happened to the town. You spent a good part of your life trying to solve that mystery,
and I want you to know I sincerely hope it's a good consolation.
For what?
Quinn stepped into the passage. The door to the mine slammed shut in a thunderous concussion of metal on metal, and its echo seemed to last forever. Then came a sound Abigail had already heard once before. The squeak of that rusted bolt sliding home inside the iron door. Then the crossbar dropping into the brackets. Then that giant padlock locking back. 1893. 58. Gloria and Rosalind sat against the rock wall, holding each other and listening to the burgeoning chaos near the iron door, where 20 armed men had gathered after hearing gunshots in the passage. But that had been some time ago. The men were growing antsy. Someone said,
"Time we rain hell on some red niggers."
"Preacher said to wait until..."
"And what if that fire escape's already lost his hair? Considered that? Sounded like quite a powder-burning contest out there."
"Mason, get up here and bring the key with you. We done waiting."
Gloria watched the unassuming Smith push his way through the cluster of miners, heading to the iron door.
"What'd you say?"
She couldn't see Stettler, who was surrounded by the mob of taller men, but his voice rose above the bedlam, far deeper and louder than his size seemed to accord.
"Said we need the key to this door. I do believe that's the only way to open it from inside."
"You see a keyhole there, Will?"
"What you talking about?"
"Preacher asked for the key, and I give it to him. What's it matter anyway? This door only opens from the outside."
"The fuck you do that for?"
"Well, he asked for it."
"Jesus, he gets himself killed. How are we gonna get out?"
Stettler ran his fingernails over the rippled surface of his bald head, which glistened with rivulets of sweat. A miner said,
"We better find some bang juice and powder. Blow that hunk of iron off its hinges."
One of the godsend's dinos said,
"Y'all see this door when we come in? It's an inch thick. Amount of powder it'd take to blow it open be a long chance this whole damn mine didn't come down on us."
Gloria turned to Rosalind, whispered,
"I can't listen to them anymore. Will you stroke my hair if I put my head in your lap, like you was doing before?"
"Of course, honey. Come here."
59. Harriet McCabe lay in the middle row of pews, hiding. There had been gunshots a short time ago, but it was quiet now save for the wind. She thought about her mama, her friend Bethany, her new doll, Samantha, which she'd had to leave behind at the shack. She was thirsty, hungry, but more than anything, cold and scared. The sun had gone to bed, and the wind made a long, low sound as it pushed against the boarded-up windows, the tiny church swaying and creaking like the hold of a ship, icy air filtering up through the space between the planks. She shivered under her mama's gray woolen cloak. Just across the aisle stood a stove in a gap between the pews, a stack of logs next to it, and she'd just decided to light a fire when the chapel doors flung open. Harriet gasped, brought her hand to her mouth. The doors slammed shut, the plank boards groaning beneath the weight of approaching footsteps. She rolled under the pew, watched a pair of arctics pass 2 feet from her head. Toward the front of the church, something thumped on the floor, and Harriet scrambled quietly to her feet, peered over the top of the bench. She saw someone in the shadow of the nave. The man was on his knees, facing the barrier separating the front pews from the stage. His arms lifted, hands open, to the simple wooden cross mounted on the wall behind the pulpit. When he spoke, she startled. His voice was loud enough to fill the sanctuary, though faltering and brittle as sandstone.
"It is finished, Lord God. Your good and faithful servant kneels before you to say that your will has been done."
He suddenly fell over, his stomach flat against the floorboards. Harriet thought he'd died, until he wept, softly at first, then outright sobbing, pounding the planks with his fists. Harriet had seen her daddy cry once before, but not like this. She'd never seen anyone in such soul-splitting anguish.
"Why?"
The word exploded, guttural, ragged, raw. He screamed it 3 times, so loudly that Harriet thought it might shatter the glass of those tall south-facing windows.
He got back onto his knees, and when he spoke again, Harriet had to strain to hear the words.
"You say you love truth. Well, here's my truth. I don't know who you are right now. I don't understand how the creator of love and mercy and compassion, the God who seared my heart in Charleston, can command his servant to lock a town into a mountain. Women, children, how can a child give you such offense? Are you not the God I think you are, of David, of Christ? You are ultimate, whatever your nature. But I need to know if I've been wrong about you. Correct my perception. You know I love you, that I chose a Cimarron's life in your service, over a woman who still haunts my dreams. If you love me, Lord, if you love me at all, infuse me with a peace that passeth all understanding, because I need it now. I'm in a bad way. This is my deepest trench, and I may not see the morning. Don't draw back from me. I've destroyed myself for you, and I am so alone."
He bowed his head, and as he cried, Stephen felt something graze his shoulder. He spun around and fell back, bristling with fear. A little girl stood before him in the darkening nave, her curls pitch black and her eyes aching with hunger.
"Why are you sad?"
she asked. Stephen pulled his cape around and wiped his face with it.
"You buggered me. How'd you get out of the mine, Harriet?"
"I've been here since long before you came, hiding from Injuns."
"You shouldn't have left your mama."
Stephen reached forward, wrapped the cloak tighter around her small frame.
"You're shivering," he said. "Let's see if we can remedy that."
He stood up and took the little girl's hand and led her over to the stove. Inside, balled up sheets of the Silverton Standard and Miner awaited a Sunday service that would never come. A wicker basket full of dried out fir cones sat under the closest pew, and Stephen took a handful and arranged the kindling and shoved in two logs. One strike from his machero did the job. He left the iron door open, and soon the flames raged, sending out eddies of heat, throwing firelight on the walls, the cold plank floor, the vaulted ceiling.
"Scoot up close, sweetie. I want you to get warm."
Harriet extended her hands toward the open door, and Stephen sat behind her, setting his hat on the floor, tying his hair up. He pulled a small bottle out of his pocket.
"Here, sip this tincture of arnica," he said.
She unscrewed the cap, took a swallow, handed the bottle back.
"What are all those dots on your face?"
she asked.
"Nothing."
Stephen wiped the sticky specks of her father's blood from his brow, his cheeks, his mouth. Then he reached into his greatcoat and withdrew the single-action army revolver, opened the loading gate behind the cylinder. 3 cartridges left.
"Is this your will, God? That I shoot your child in the back of the head? Because I will do it. I am your faithful servant, but please, please, if there is any other way..."
"I'm hungry," Harriet said.
"We'll get something in our bellies here in a minute."
He coughed to mask the sound of the hammer thumbing back.
"I got a doll for Christmas, Mr. Cole."
Stephen blinked through the tears.
"What's her name?"
He choked on the words as he put the revolver to the back of her head.
"Samantha. She has red hair."
He knew he'd be sick after, fought off the urge to jam the barrel down his own throat.
"Is this your will? Speak now or forever."
"She has 2 dresses, and my favorite thing is to comb her hair."
When Stephen touched the trigger, it came. Peace flooding through him, warm liquid light.
"Thank you,"
he whispered, and slid the revolver back into his coat. Harriet glanced back, said,
"You're crying again."
"It's okay. These are happy tears. God is so good."
Harriet cocked her head.
"Where are all the Injuns?"
she asked.
"How old are you, Harriet?"
6 years.
"I think you're old enough to know something. Last night God spoke to me. He told me that his judgment was coming down upon abandon, that I was to be the instrument of his wrath, his brimstone and fire."
So there weren't ever any heathens?
No. Although at times today God allowed me to believe there were. He let me see the heathens when I was standing at the saw blade. Let me believe the lie. Showed me how to use it.
Then where'd everybody go?
Do you believe in God, Harriet?
Yes.
Does your father ever get upset with you? Like when you're disobedient? When you don't listen to what he says?
Yeah. When Mama's gone, he hits my bottom real hard with the metal part of his belt.
But that's his job, to punish you when you misbehave. In the same way, God is the father of abandon, and all the people who live here are his children. But do you know what?
What?
The people of this town were very wicked.
Why?
They were greedy, sinful. They didn't love God. Thought only of themselves and what they wanted. They were obsessed with gold, and some of them were very evil and did terrible things to others. They took what didn't belong to them, caused incredible pain.
That's wrong. You're supposed to be nice.
Yes, you are. And that's why God decided to punish everyone who lived in abandon.
What about Bethany and Mama?
Even them.
But they aren't evil, are they?
Listen, Harriet. We can't start questioning God. Why he chooses to punish some but not others? We might not understand, but that's our shortcoming. We can only love and obey him. Her bottom lip began to quiver.
I want to see Mama.
Come on, sweetie, listen to me. God told me not to punish you, that he loves you, that your heart is good. He wants me to take care of you.
What about Mama and Daddy?
You need to shuck that question. Don't ask it again. Harriet turned away from him and stared into the flames. Stephen put his hands on her delicate shoulders. Let's walk to my cabin, he said. I'll build another fire and make us supper.
Did God punish Samantha?
No, sweetheart.
She's alone and scared at home on my bed.
Stephen stood up, so tired that he felt he could lie down on his pine bough mattress and sleep for 30 years. We'll stop by your old house and get her. Stephen helped Harriet up and took her by the hand. Then the preacher and the child walked out of the church together. The night was clear, the moon full and rising.
Infuse me with a peace that passeth all understanding.
Pinpoints of starlight twinkled, among them the rusty bulb of Mars. Abandon lay dark and silent in its canyon, and from high above Stephen heard a faint sound like a distant stamp mill. They were beating on that iron door inside the mountain. 2009. 60. Abigail approached the iron door. No handle, no doorknob, no keyhole. Lawrence came up and pushed against it and yelled Quinn's name. She tried to rein back the fear in her voice.
Did that just happen?
Lawrence backpedaled, then ran at the door and drove the heel of his boot into the metal. It made a clatter that resonated through the cavern and died. He collapsed on the rock and squeezed his ankle, wincing from the pain. Around the door's perimeter, the rock had been worn down, chipped away. Abigail shone her headlamp over the surface of the metal. It was covered in marks of desperation, dings and numerous indentations, as if someone had assaulted the door with an assortment of implements. She saw bullet grooves, scattered dimples created by buckshot. In the middle section, a large swath of metal had been dented in, and she imagined only a boulder carried by a group of men could have made such an impression in the indomitable door. June wandered over from the chamber.
What happened? She asked.
Quinn locked us in.
Why in the world would he do that?
No idea.
June spent a moment pushing on the door. She suddenly screamed Quinn's name.
Save your energy, Abigail said. I think people have tried everything to break it down, even ramming a boulder into it. And they obviously didn't make it out.
Oh my God. We're gonna die in here like the rest of them.
She staggered back and began to hyperventilate.
How is this?
Okay, hang on. Lawrence struggled up off the rock. Let's everybody just take a breath.
We can all get horrified and hysterical, but how's that going to save our lives? We're still going to be right here when we finally calm down, locked inside this mountain. So let's skip the part where everyone freaks out. Most important thing now is light. It's as important as oxygen, and it's running out. We only need one headlamp going. Turn yours off. I'll keep mine on. Two headlamps went dark. All right. Backpacks. Let's find out what supplies we have to work with. I think I left... Fuck! Lawrence ran over to the alcove and swept his headlamp in the vicinity of the 10 burlap sacks. It isn't here! I left my pack near the gold and now it's gone. I had some rope, batteries, water.
Mine's gone too, June said. I left it by the door before we walked into the chamber. All I have is Em's camera.
I still have mine, Abigail said. She unclipped her hip belt and knelt down on the rock and unzipped it as Lawrence provided light.
So, I've got... not much. Gloves, hat, notepad, roll of film, 2 granola bars, matches, 2 water bottles, but only one's full. Damn, I thought I had extra batteries.
All right, let's sit down and talk this out. I'm turning my headlamp off for now. They sat together in the perfect darkness, 15 feet from the iron door. Abigail closed her eyes, took a few deep breaths in an attempt to slow her heart and settle her mind. Lawrence said, I know it's creepy in here, and we're surrounded by the remains of people who died because they were locked in this mine, but I would urge us to keep them and their fate as far from our thoughts as possible.
June wept softly. I'm sorry, she said. I'm sorry, I'm trying not to.
Abigail reached out, took hold of her hand. We have 3 headlamps, and the brutal truth is, if we run out of light before we find a way out, we will die in here. We should store the headlamps we aren't using in Abby's pack so they don't get damaged. We also have 32 ounces of water. That's barely more than a glass each. We'll drink it in small sips every few hours, make it last as long as possible. Hopefully there's water somewhere in this cave. Who knows if it's fit to drink, but we may have to try. Same deal with the granola bars. We'll ration them out in little bites over time.
How long can we survive once the water runs out? June asked.
3 days? Maybe longer, since the heat's not going to be an issue. So now we have an important decision to make. We can't just sit here and hope to be rescued, because even if search and rescue comes to abandon looking for us, they sure as hell won't find us in here.
Maybe we should get some rocks and chip away around the door, June said.
Abigail said, that's one option, but I looked at the door and it's my sense that that's the big mistake the residents of Abandon made. They tried to break down the door or to chip around it. But this is hard, hard rock in here, and I'm certain we'd die of thirst before we made any real progress. I bet that most of the people in here wore themselves out fooling with that door. Then all they could do was lie down in that chamber to die, with no strength left to go look for more water or another way out.
And no more light, Lawrence said.
Exactly. I mean, all the residents of Abandon couldn't break through that door. We have no chance.
Then what's the alternative? June asked.
Lawrence said, looks to me like this is a mine that, as the men were blasting and expanding it, encroached into a natural cave. I'm sure that the door is not the only exit from this mountain. I know we're tired, but I think we have to get up right now, while we still have a little strength and food and water, and try to find another way out.
June said, you're suggesting we wander blindly through a cave?
You see another viable option?
What if we get lost?
We are already lost. Pretend that door isn't there, that it's solid rock. Might as well be.
Abigail said, it scares me to death, but yeah, I agree that's our only option at this point. Should we split up? June asked. That would increase our chances of finding a way out.
Actually, it wouldn't. Because we're on the clock here in terms of light, we can only spend as much time looking for another exit as our batteries allow. If we split up, we'll be burning through our headlamps twice or 3 times as fast.
June said, if anyone had ever made it out of this mine alive, you'd have heard about it, right, Lawrence?
He turned on his headlamp, and the others blinked in the sudden light. More than likely. 1893. 61. It took 8 miners to hoist the boulder. 700 pounds of solid granite that ignited back cracking and groans. They started in the chamber, 15 yards back,
freighting it slowly over the rock, carefully accelerating to a jog as they neared the iron door. The collision was tremendous. The front third of the boulder shivered off and broke the feet of three men. The surface of the door had barely caved. The Godsend's cager grabbed a hammer shotgun leaning against the wall, sighted up the door, fired a shell of buckshot. As the metal sparked, other men drew their revolvers and rifles, hammers squeezing back, levers cocking, the mine exploding in a cacophony of gunfire and filling with an acrid haze. When the shooting stopped, the door stood defiant. The metal covered in silver chinks, but no real damage done, except for the young man who lay quivering on the floor, a hole through his cheek, blood frothing out of his mouth onto the rock in a pink geyser. Voices rose up, growing louder, competing to be heard. Stettler held up two shadow geese and hollered for silence, but no one listened in the swarm of shouting men.
"We're all gonna peg out now.
Better save the lump oil. Keep charging the door.
Used to go that way, but the chute's caved in.
No food, no water. Preacher left us in the soup.
Gonna run out of light. Hobble your lips.
Don't know your ass from a hole in the ground.
Shut the fuck up."
Meanwhile, Bessie McCabe stood in the center of the chamber, screaming for Harriet again. Screaming until she couldn't breathe, until she felt like she was suffocating on choke damp, the chaos only stoking the hysteria in her head. She overloaded, spotted the small boulder, fell to her knees, and crawled toward it. She heard the miners shooting again, babies screaming, someone praying nearby. Bessie got up on her knees, found two handholds in the rock, and, with every ounce of strength and zero hesitation, slammed her head down into the boulder. She heard the crack before she felt it, and blood ran between her eyes. When she came to, the cavern was inverted and spinning. She struggled back onto her knees, located the handholds, and managed two more blows before losing consciousness again. The next time she came around, she knew she'd done the job. A crowd of revolving, blurry faces surrounded her, and their voices and the gunshots and weeping and shouting all blended into a steady rush like the noise of a waterfall. Her head lay in a warm, expanding pool, and she knew it was her blood and hoped it meant the end, thinking only of her daughter now, praying the Injuns hadn't gotten her, and that wherever she awoke, Harriet would be there too. As her brain seized, she went back almost 10 months, to a February morning on the plains of West Kansas, she and Harriet aboard a Union Pacific train chugging to Denver. Staring off in the distance, she'd seen them lifting out of the horizon like a bank of clouds. Thought they were coming into weather until she overheard another passenger say to his companion, "Have a look at the snowy range." And as she died on the floor of that mine on Christmas night, she relived with a sort of bewildered nostalgia all the excitement she'd felt, watching the Front Range rise and rise as the train steamed west, a dream and a dare at once. She'd pulled Harriet into her lap and pointed out the window.
"That's where Daddy is and where we're going. That's our future, Sweet Pea."
And she'd believed it, too, with all her heart. 2009. 62. Starting out proved simple enough. They took the only passage that branched off from the chamber, Lawrence leading with the headlamp, followed by Abigail and June. They hadn't walked 30 feet before Lawrence stopped, said,
"Well, guys, here we are. First choice of many."
The main tunnel continued on, at least as far as his headlamp shone, but there was also an opening in the rock nearby. Lawrence knelt down, looked through the hole.
"A snug fit, but it definitely goes somewhere."
"Don't you think we should stick with the larger passageways?" Abigail asked.
"I honestly don't..." He gasped. "There's a skeleton in here and a pair of wrist irons. This might have been a prisoner."
"Yeah, let's stick with the main passage for now."
So they continued on, soon leaving all signs of mining activity. Holes drilled in the rock for dynamite, rusted cans of black blasting powder, empty carbide kegs, strips of railroad track, drill steels, support timbers, and emerged into a natural cave, ceasing to follow the path of any particular tunnel, moving instead from room to room, some smaller than a closet, others larger than that first cavern, and the rock formations becoming more alien the deeper they ventured. Stalactites hung down from the roof, spilling their corrosive solutions into drip holes on the floor.
Abigail ran her hands over walls of breccia, fragments of rock, fossils of bone and prehistoric crustaceans cemented together in sandstone. An hour in, they came upon a richly decorated grotto. Lawrence's headlamp shone up at the ceiling, where stalactites bunched together, row upon row, like shark's teeth. In the center, they'd melded into a strange conglomerate that reminded Abigail of a chandelier. Against the nearest wall, they resembled a pipe organ. In a far corner, the long tentacles of jellyfish. They wandered into a smooth-walled tube, the ceiling just a foot above Lawrence's head. As they progressed through the elliptical passage, the walls grew farther apart and the ceiling lowered. Soon they had to walk hunched over, then squatting, then crawling on their knees, and finally their bellies, dragging themselves through the flattener on their forearms, just 16 inches between the ceiling and the floor. They'd been moving along this way for 5 minutes when Abigail yelled, "I'm getting claustrophobic!" She couldn't see Lawrence's light, felt trapped in total darkness, the warmth of her own breath blowing back into her face when she exhaled against the rock. Something grabbed her ankle, but there wasn't enough space to turn her head. June whispered, "They're all around us, Abigail. They won't stop talking to me." Lawrence yelled back, "I hear something up ahead." They pushed on, the ceiling scraping the top of Abigail's head, her left leg beginning to bleed again, the crawling murder on her tailbone. "I can't breathe," she thought. Then, "Yes, you can. It's just in your mind." She had to tilt her head to the side and flatten her shoulders in order to writhe her way through. "What if we get stuck? I can't even move my limbs enough to turn myself around. This would be a horrible way to die." June cried, whispering in the darkness behind her, and Abigail had started to tell Lawrence to just turn the fuck around when she heard it too. White noise. The bulb of his headlamp swung toward her. "You're almost there," he said. When the tube ended, less than a foot of space remained between the floor and the ceiling. Abigail squeezed her way through, and Lawrence grabbed her by the arms, helped her find her footing. "Where is this?" she asked. Lawrence turned and let his light run up the 60-foot walls of an immense hall. "Oh my God." They stood at the edge of a subterranean lake, 50 feet across, 2 feet deep. On the other side, a 4-foot waterfall plunged into a pool out of a fissure in the rock. The pool overflowed, fed the lake flooding into a hole that shooted the mineral water into the depths of the mountain. The hall resonated with the crush of the waterfall, and the sound made Abigail think of her favorite spot in Central Park, the fountain at Cherry Hill. If you sat close, it was loud enough to drown out the city noise. While Lawrence helped June out of the tube, Abigail bent down to touch the inky water. Freezing cold. Barely the temperature of fresh snowmelt. When the beam of Lawrence's headlamp passed over the surface, she saw the lake bed consisted of white crystals. Tiny translucent fish swam among them, eyeless in the dark. They sat on the rock shore of that lake, caught in eternal night, sharing sips of water and pieces of a granola bar. Abigail's head dropped and her eyes closed.
"Wake up, Abby. We have to keep moving."
She sat up, rubbed her eyes.
"How long was I asleep?"
5 minutes.
"Where's June?"
He pointed to a breakdown on the far side of the lake, where a section of the ceiling had fallen. June crawled around on the rock.
"She's acting strange, huh?"
Lawrence said. "Her husband was murdered in front of her. You forget that?" They followed the shore to the breakdown and joined June on the shattered rock.
"What I'm thinking," Lawrence said, "is that maybe these rocks and boulders are blocking the opening of another passage. Help me move some of this."
"No," June said. "Leave it be. That's a bad place."
"Sorry, but I don't see any other easy way out of this hall."
Abigail and Lawrence began picking up the rocks they could handle, tossing them aside. As she worked to clear the scree, Abigail realized she'd already begun to lose her sense of time. It seemed possible they'd been in this cave for an entire day. As she lifted one of the larger rocks and dropped it on the growing pile, the waft hit her. Abigail stepped back.
"You smell that? It's like rotten eggs. Come give me some light, Lawrence. I may have broken through."
Lawrence moved one more rock, the opening now spacious enough for them to climb through. He shined the light inside, said,
"Damn, it's just a tiny..."
Abigail shrieked. Lawrence looked in again, jerked back.
Oh, Jesus.
Is she alive? Abigail whispered. She looks very alive.
The breakdown had covered a recess in the wall, and inside a young woman leaned against a flat-topped rock, her left arm draped over a colony of gypsum flowers, their crystal blooms curling between her fingers. She was naked, slender but curvy, her head resting in the crook of her arm, as if she'd just sat down and gone to sleep, her left hand coated in wax. Lawrence whispered,
"Beautiful."
Her hair was long and black, and her full lips still held color, deep maroon. She was pink-skinned, blood still in her veins.
"She must have gotten trapped in there," Abigail said.
"No, I believe this woman was alive and abandoned in 1893.
"You're telling me this flawless corpse is 116 years old?"
"Look at the pile of clothes. Those boots? Custom maids, they called them. Those canvas trousers, the shawl, look like the outfit of a modern-day woman to you?"
"Well, that's impossible. There's no decay. She hardly looks dead."
"I know. It's the most incredible thing I've ever seen."
He stepped back from the opening and inhaled a few clean breaths of air.
"That rotten egg smell," he said. "Sulfur gas. Very toxic and probably what killed this woman. But it also preserved her, killing all the aerobic bacteria inside her and around her. That Christmas in abandon, she was probably doing what we're doing now, just trying to find a way out. Maybe she saw this nook, decided to rest. Then the ceiling came down, entombed her, sealed her in. In an airtight environment, the sulfur gas had nowhere to go, so there's no decomposition. Kept her literally frozen in time. Look at her. That's the face of someone who lived and breathed in the town of abandon. Bet she had a story to tell. God, she's lovely."
June suddenly screamed. "She's looking at me! She won't stop looking at me!" Abigail said,
"That woman's dead, honey. Been that way for quite a while."
Lawrence lifted a rock, placed it back in front of the opening.
"What are you doing?"
Abigail asked.
"If fresh air gets in, she will decay. We should seal it back up. Leave her as we found her."
63. They climbed out of the waterfall room through a blind shaft that accessed another passage, spent several hours moving through a network of tunnels that crisscrossed and dead-ended and turned back into themselves. For the first time, Abigail felt lost. They stopped to rest in a room where the stalactites and stalagmites had merged together in the shape of hourglass columns. Abigail sat up against the cold calcite, staring at her watch. 11:03 a.m. They'd been rambling through the cave for 5.5 hours. She hadn't had any meaningful sleep for 29.
"I really need to rest," Abigail said. "I'm on fumes here."
Lawrence said, "These daylight hours are too precious to waste. There's no point searching for a way out at night. Suppose we walked through a room when it was dark outside that had a daylight hole. We'd never know. So we have to keep going until the sun sets."
"But that's another 8 hours. I can't..."
"Abby, do you understand that we have maybe 3 or 4 days to find a way out? And that after that, without water, we'll be too weak to cover any ground. It'll be over for us then."
She rested her forehead on her knees and cried. The constant motion of Lawrence's light beam wreaked havoc on Abigail's stomach. Or maybe it was this cold, deep underground air, the jagged rock walls narrowing over the last 50 yards. The tunnel beginning to slope gradually down. Abigail thought,
"Great, we're going deeper into the mountain."
She instantly felt guilty for complaining to herself. Bad as things were, the last 12 hours had been infinitely worse to June.
"How are you holding up?" Abigail asked. "We can rest any time you want, just say when."
June made no response. Glancing back, Abigail said,
"Everything all..."
Even in the paltry shreds of light that slipped back from her father's headlamp, Abigail could see that there was no one behind her.
"Lawrence? She's gone."
He stopped, shone his headlamp back up the empty tunnel.
"How long?"
"I don't know. Those were the first words I'd said to her in 10 or 15 minutes.
"June?"
Lawrence screamed. His voice ricocheted down the tunnel, stirred up a single echo, and quickly died away. No answer.
"Well, come on," Abigail said. "We have to find her."
They jogged back up the tunnel.
After a minute or so, Abigail thought she heard something.
Lawrence,
she said.
Lawrence!
He spun around.
I think I heard...
A scream exploded from the bowels of the mountain. It ended abruptly, but its reverberations went on and on. Lawrence said,
What the hell?
Was that June? Another scream ripped through the cave, this one farther away.
She sounds like she's in agony,
Abigail said. They rushed up the tunnel as the screaming continued, arrived after 2 minutes of hard running at a split in the passage. A woman's voice shouted,
Where are you?
I can't tell which one it's coming from, Abigail said.
Please, God, just kill me!
This way, Lawrence said, and he started into the larger of the two passageways.
I'm so thirsty!
They moved through a series of grottos, the screams getting louder.
I'm still alive! Please, finish it! Kill me!
Lawrence stopped.
What's wrong? Abigail whispered.
He shook his head. Thought I saw something in that room up ahead.
What?
I'm not sure. It moved fast. Forget it.
I don't hear her anymore.
Lawrence shouted,
June! Where are you? Help us find you!
The cave seemed to hold its breath.
I hate this place, Abigail said.
They worked their way through a forest of stalagmites, interspersed with pillars of bedrock, coming at last into a stagnant room with feathery blue fungi clinging to the walls and moving in slow motion waves, like underwater seagrass. 3 steps into the next room, Lawrence froze, and Abigail heard him whisper,
My God.
As he sank down onto the floor, his headlamp shone on the expanding pool of dark blood that flowed out of June Tozer's head. She lay on her back, beside the small boulder she'd used.
Everything's spinning, she mumbled.
They knelt at June's side. Abigail took her hand, laced their fingers. In the poor light, only the volume of blood hinted at the extent of damage June had managed to self-inflict. She groaned, her lips moving, searching for the strength to form words.
I couldn't stand it. They were all around me, trying to use me. Where's Emmett?
She tried to call out to him, but his name miscarried in her throat.
He's not here right now,
Lawrence said.
I'll be with him soon,
she mouthed between wet breaths.
And Ty.
Who?
Their son, Abigail said. Yeah, Ty too. I want to hear him laugh again.
You will, sweetie. Abigail was crying, overcome by June's deathbed desperation. Wishful thinking and unanswerable questions begging answers. Any semblance of truth be damned.
He's always been a little boy in my mind. You think he's grown up into...
She choked, then coughed, a mist of blood sputtering through the gaps between her teeth.
Try not to talk, Lawrence said. Will I still be his mom? I was for 6 beautiful...
She moaned, her eyes closing. Abigail placed her ear on June's sternum, listening for the rise and fall of lungs expanding, deflating.
I'm so sorry. Lawrence wept. This was my fault.
June's chest swelled, Abigail's head lifting. Then it fell, down, down. One long exhalation, all air expelled, and never rose again. 64. At 3 in the afternoon, Abigail heard Lawrence say,
There's light up ahead.
The two of them entered the largest cavern yet, more than 100 feet across, filled with enormous spires that rose from the floor. A spring bubbled out of a crack in the wall, speleothem deposits hanging like curtains from the high ceiling. They stood in the luminous shaft that angled down, bathing them in daylight. 40 feet above, a chimney bored through the ceiling, and Abigail saw a distant patch of gray at the end of it.
Never get there, Lawrence said. Don't even get your hopes up.
He walked over to the spring.
Abigail, bring your empty water bottle.
She went to her father and dug the Nalgene bottle out of her pack. Lawrence held the plastic lip against the rock, and with the bottle halfway full, he strode into the middle of the cavern and held it up to the natural light. The water was cloudy, sediment already settling on the bottom. He sniffed it. Potent sulfur smell. He sipped the water, winced, and spit it out. Very mineralized. Tastes bitter and acidic. Much stronger than the hot springs in Pagosa. I don't know if this is even safe to drink. Abigail gazed up at the window in the ceiling, beating back the despair. This was far worse than traveling through the dark zone, she decided. This was throwing it in your face, a glimpse of the unreachable, heaven from hell. When they finally stopped for the day, a smothering depression had descended on them. It was supper time, but there would be nothing more to eat than a nibble from the last granola bar, a sip or two of water. They would sleep in their damp and filthy clothes, in the cold, on a hard rock floor, and when they awoke, it would still be dark. Abigail and Lawrence sat against the wall in a small room with a low ceiling, a space that resembled 50 other rooms they'd passed through during the last 15 hours.
"We shouldn't have left her there," Abigail said.
"What could we do? Dragging her through the cave with us won't bring her or Emmett back, will it?" Lawrence switched off his headlamp. Abigail, desperate to hear his voice, anything to break the uncompromising black hole silence, said,
"You found the remains of Abandon, and you now know how they died. But you still don't really understand what happened, do you?"
"Nope. And Quinn, if that's really his name, throws a new wrench into the equation."
"But knowing they all died in this cave?"
"My gut tells me that, like us, they were locked in here. Maybe by Otha Wallace and Billy McCabe. But the fact that the gold was locked in as well kind of refutes that theory."
Sitting there in the dark, listening to him talk, Abigail felt shards of cold begin to prick her face, wondered if it might be the first sign of frostbite or hypothermia.
"Why do you think Quinn did this to us?" she said. "Any idea?"
"Beyond plain old greed? No. We should probably drink some water."
Lawrence turned on his lamp, reached for the bottle. At first, Abigail mistook them for dust motes in the light beam, then realized these white things were actually snowflakes.
"Lawrence," she said, "it's snowing in here."
He looked up. "Oh my God. I saw the chimney when we first came in, but it was already dark outside. I assumed it was just another blind shaft."
His headlamp spotlighted the hole in the ceiling, snow floating down through it, melting on the cave floor. Abigail got up.
"Lawrence, can you lift me up there?"
She straddled his shoulders and he stood slowly, his legs shuddering under the strain.
"Scoot to the right. You're crushing me into the ceiling."
Abigail peered up the narrow chimney, wondered how far to the surface, if it even stayed wide enough for her to get there.
"Okay, let me down."
Lawrence bent his knees, eased back down onto the floor. Abigail said,
"I think I can climb up there if you lift me a little farther up the hole."
"Well, I know I couldn't do it even if my ankle wasn't wrecked. And with no rope, only one of us can get out. How would you feel about going alone, trying to find help? I can draw a map on your notepad, get you back to the trailhead. You'd have to find the keys to Scott Suburban. I'm not sure if they're with him or in his pack at the campsite."
"And I'll get my cell. Try to call for help from the pass."
Lawrence sighed, relief enveloping his face like the loosening of taut cables.
"You should get some sleep before you go, Abby. A few hours at least."
The alarm on Abigail's watch seemed to beep 5 seconds after she'd closed her eyes. She'd slept for 4 hours on the cold rock, dreamless and deep. She turned onto her side and faced Lawrence. His breath warmed her face, and in that virgin dark, she caught his scent. A repressed relic from those precious years when he was daddy, and not the remnants of aftershave. No superficial mosaic of man-made chemicals, but his core, lifeblood odor. And it carried her back even further than the smell of cut grass and school bus seats and snow cones.
"You awake?" he whispered. "My alarm just went off. Guess it's time. You weren't asleep?"
"Been thinking."
"What about?"
"Those gold bricks. The greedy people they've killed through the centuries. People they're still killing. But you and the Tozers didn't come into these mountains for greed. Emmett and June are dead because of me. You're in this cave because of me. And I'm sorry. Beyond words, I'm sorry. It won't change a damn thing now, but I need to say it. Need you to hear it. I know what a selfish, no-good fuck I am.
and what you said in the boarding house. You were right, Abby. It's all about me. Always has been.
He cupped her face in his gloved hands.
Take this with you, he whispered. If you make it back to me, if you don't, my leaving wasn't your fault or your mother's. I left because something inside of me was broken. Still is. I hurt people I love, who love me, and I don't know why. But my little girl, my beautiful, perfect little girl, I'm so sorry I hurt you. So sorry you got me for a daddy.
Abigail fought like hell against it. A realignment, the unraveling of an old stubborn knot. With Abigail astride her father's shoulders, she was still a foot shy of any usable handhold.
I'm just not far enough up the chimney, she said. Push me higher.
As she lifted off Lawrence's shoulders, her headlamp illuminated the closest jug, a few inches from her fingertips.
Almost there,
she said, reaching out and grabbing the jug with both hands.
Got it,
Lawrence said. Find a foothold. Abigail's fingers had already begun to cramp, and her feet were scrambling for purchase.
I can't find anything. Oh, God, I'm slipping. I can't.
Feel that? Lawrence yelled as he jammed the toe of her right boot into a crevice. Let your weight rest on your feet now. Abigail settled onto her legs.
Just take your time. Get your strength back up.
As she caught her breath, Abigail shone her headlamp up the chimney. It appeared to narrow farther up, but the handholds were plentiful. She cinched down the straps of her day pack, then reached over her head for the next handhold, a crack in the wall wide enough to slide her fist into. She pulled herself up and moaned, the pain in her tailbone excruciating.
Remember to climb with your feet, Lawrence yelled up to her. Otherwise you'll tire out.
She tested her weight on a big chalk stone wedged in the chimney, decided to trust it, and made the next move. Rested for 30 seconds, then made another. As long as she allowed her legs to bear the weight, her arms didn't cramp. She climbed through a 10-foot section filled with bomb-proof buckets. Then the rock became wet, then icy, then snow-dusted, the handholds dwindling. Suddenly, she had nothing to grab.
I'm stuck, she yelled. No handholds!
Chimney the rest of the way up!
His voice sounded distant, like he'd shouted up to her from the bottom of a well.
Push your feet against the opposite walls! Hold yourself up with the pressure!
She stood perched on a thin lip, half an inch wide, legs trembling with the onset of a paralyzing weakness.
I'm gonna fall, she screamed.
Listen to me. Take your right leg, dig it into the wall at your back, and keep the ball of your left foot pressed hard into the wall facing you.
She tried it, the soles of her boots slipping on the rock. Pushed harder, pain radiating out of her tailbone so intensely she felt it in her fillings and nearly fainted. She finally regained purchase and inched her way up again. Her boots jammed into the rock, taking handholds and footholds where she could find them, chimneying where she couldn't. Snow poured down on her, and she heard the shriek of wind just above. Abigail glanced down the chimney, Lawrence's headlamp just a pinpoint of light 70 feet below. Thought of the night he left, all those years ago, her first concrete memory. And she wondered if, as her father watched her climb to the surface, leaving him stranded in the dark, it felt anything to him like it had to her the night she'd watched him walk out of her bedroom door.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please insert disc number 7.